All right, so look, here's where we're at. I didn't get to finish the end of the last lecture. What I'm going to try to do today is do the lecture scheduled for today and leave enough time at the end to at least quickly go through some of the main points from the end of the last lecture. That is, explaining the character of the great financial crisis, of the Great Recession, and how to think about that as a failure of our market institutions to cope with certain kinds of stresses and what should be done. But I'll begin by the topic for today, and then this lecture will wrap up this whole first block of the course, which I'm sure you all remember. On Thursday you have the first midterm exam, which I hope you don't feel a lot of anxiety about. If you have done the reading carefully and attended the lectures, and if in going through the PowerPoints it all makes sense to you, you should do just fine. There's nothing tricky in the exam. It's meant to just tap whether you've done the work and understand the core ideas that I've been hammering away at. So, the topic of today is what I call high road capitalism. I mean, after all, when all is said and done, I've talked about market failures, free rider problems, externalities, all these things that bear on particular sectors. Healthcare has very special problems as a kind of economic activity. Public transportation has special problems. The environment, of course, poses huge problems. But mostly what people really care about when they think about how well the economy is doing is, what does it do for people's basic standards of living? You know, does it generate jobs? Does it generate income? Does it generate security? So what we want to do to begin in this lecture is just do a basic economic balance sheet for the United States at the beginning of the 21st century. How healthy is the economy that we have, that's organized fundamentally around relatively lightly regulated markets, in spite of what you might hear in general among political debates? We're not a heavily regulated market. We have regulations, but compared to other capitalist countries of comparable economic development, we have a relatively lightly regulated market. Our labor markets are pretty freewheeling. Employers can fire workers when they want to, except for certain special prohibitions. You can't fire somebody for on racial or gender grounds. So there are a few constraints on employers, but mostly employers can fire you. We have extremely low minimum wages, so the wages in markets are pretty much determined by supply and demand. We do have occupational and safety health regulations, but they're not enforced very, very rigorously, so pretty much you have a freewheeling set of organizational relations. Environmental relations are often, you know, objected to, but again, our environmental regulations are not more severe than other countries. There's more attention to how they affect profitability and business climate here than in most other places. We're not a heavily regulated economy. We're not an economy that provides lots and lots of subsidies to maintain good jobs and good wages. So we've got a kind of experiment. How well is the United States doing, given that over the last 30 years or so, 40 years, we've gone through repeated rounds of less regulation, not more regulation? So let's first do a balance sheet, and then I'll do a diagnosis, and then a discussion of what one might do about the situation. All right, so these are mostly graphs that are in the book, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time going through them in detail. This is the graph showing the path of average real weekly earnings of non-supervisory workers in the private sector. So these aren't This isn't about government workers, it's about workers in the private sector. The scale, by the way, it's not even numbers of years, it's been squished. So 1947 to 67 is the first jump. It would make the graph just too big to have equal spaces for each. And I wanted to emphasize what's happened in recent decades. So beginning sometime in the early 1970s, we hit a peak of what occurred in the post-World War II period, and then a gradual decline, and then a gradual rise, but only basically back up to where we were in the early 1970s. Basically, as a first approximation, if you want to think about it, you know, just to give you the summary idea, over the last four decades, on balance, average real weekly earnings of private sector non-supervisory employees haven't changed. They have not gone up in the last four decades. If we break this period down and look at the annual rate of growth of family income by income group in the first three decades following the Second World War compared to roughly the last three decades. The data in the graph, actually, I just noticed has been updated to 2012. The title just says 2005, but this has been updated somewhat. So in those first 30 years, if you divide up households by fifths and then separate out the top 5%, that is this, if you're just looking at the income distribution among households, not individuals, but households, the top 5% are the richest in terms of income, 5% of the population, of the households, and then we look at the remaining population in terms of fifths. Between 1947 and 79, the lowest fifth of the economy, the poorest 20% of households, had the greatest gains. The top 5% had the lowest gains. I think that the title of this isn't correct. This is, the annual rate of growth wasn't 122%. I think that, so I'm sure it's correct in the book because we were very careful what we wrote. It's not the case that every year you had 122% increase in the earnings of people in the bottom fifth of the economy. So I think this must be the rate of growth over the period. 100% rate of growth means you, 122% means you more than doubled your income, your household income over that period. This must be over the whole period. Is that what it says in the, what? Yeah, just change, right. Yeah. Okay, so I will correct the slide before I post it so that when you look at the slide, you'll get it correctly. But it's the same graph in the book. Now, that's kind of what you would like, right? If we're going to have economic growth and a robust economy, I think most people would say, gee, it would be awfully nice if the people who are the worst off had the best improvement. There's improvement for everybody. This is pretty even, actually. The difference between the top 5% and the bottom 20% isn't huge, but that's a pretty much of an equal improvement. This kind of corresponds to the idea that a rising tide lifts all boats, so to speak. But if anything, the bias is towards the bottom end of the income distribution. We'll compare that to what's happened over the last 40 years or so. The conditions of people in the bottom fifth have gotten worse. They are worse now than they were 40 years ago. And by far, the largest improvement has gone to the very top. There's something screwy about an economy, in my judgment, in which you have a lot of economic development, an improvement of the overall productivity and income-generating capacity of the economy, and the benefits of that growth don't just disproportionately go to the top. In that period of growth, things get worse for people at the bottom. Something's wrong when that is the way an economic system works. This graph shows something about what's going on here. So productivity growth, remember, the green line here, productivity is just how much output do you get per hour of input, right? So the more productive the economy is, the less you have to work to get the same output, or the more output you get if you work the same. This shows the relationship between the growth of productivity over the last 45 years or so and the growth in average compensation and median compensation. Now, median compensation, that's wages and benefits, so it's the whole package of what you get. The median is the person right in the middle of the distribution. The average is above the median because we have lots of high earners. That pulls the average up. The distribution is skewed in that way so that high earnings raise the average. So the first thing to note is we've had huge productivity growth in this period, but it hasn't been reflected in improvements at the median for the average person. The person who is right at the middle person, the middle earner. There has been an improvement of average compensation, which means that the productivity increases in terms of earnings get turned into greater earnings for high earners rather than for the person in the middle. But note the following. There is also a growing gap even between average compensation and productivity growth. So not all of the income being generated by productivity growth is going to any earners. Well, who's it going to? Well, it's going to owners. That is, there's another aspect of distribution, which is not just the difference between low wages and high wages, but between wage earners altogether of whatever sort, wage and salary earners, and people who get their income from profits, that is from owning the firms that organize this productivity. There's an increasing gap then between the amount of revenue generated by firms that goes to the owners of firms, the share owners and other owners of firms, and the amount that goes to the workers in firms. And that wasn't always the case. If you look in the early part of this period, until about 1981, early 80s, late 70s, growth of productivity pretty much tracked the growth of compensation and the growth of, for both the median and the average. And that's reflected in that earlier graph for households, where we saw that in that early period, when there was economic growth, pretty much everyone benefited. Here's another way of looking at this. This is the annual growth in productivity and compensation during periods of economic expansion. So economic expansion are the periods when things are getting better. And then we have economic recessions or depressions where things are getting worse. And again, we see the same kind of issue, that median compensation growth was high and relatively in balance with productivity growth in the first period. Between 1983 and the early 2000s, it was extremely low. And in the most recent, relative to productivity growth, and you get strong productivity growth in every expansion, as you would expect. And when you have an expansion, you're using all of your resources to the fullest, so your productivity goes up. But look at the most recent expansion. Even during the expansion, now this stops in 2011, there's been in the last years some growth in median compensation. It probably has not yet counteracted this significant drop that occurred in the early years of the expansion. We have, again, substantial productivity growth, but negative growth in compensation, even during the expansion. Here's another, just to hammer home this point. This is the percent of the share of income growth received by the top 10% and the bottom 90% of earners during expansions. You know, so this basically says who benefits from an expansion. When you have economic growth and an expansion, who gains from such prosperous times? Again, in the early period, you can see that the bottom 90% of the population had their earnings go up significantly. They got a significant percentage of total income growth during periods of expansion. This declined dramatically in the 80s and 90s, and basically has disappeared since then. Since the beginning of the 21st century, there has been basically no growth of income in the bottom 90% during periods of expansion. All of the gains have gone to the top 10%. Indeed, in the most recent expansion, at least through 2012, the top percent got more than 100% of the gains. That is, and that's because the bottom 90% continued to have losses. Here's another way of looking at these problems. This is based on my own research on patterns of job growth. So I shifted the analysis directly from earnings to the kinds of jobs that get created. And I won't go into the technical details of this research, but you can basically divide the entire economic structure into good jobs and bad jobs. And we can rank them from the very best kind of job to the very worst kind of job, and then divide them into equal numbers of jobs. So we have the lowest 20% of jobs, and the next 20%, and the highest 20%. And we ask, where's the job growth occurring? So you can have income increasing among the best jobs, or you can have the best jobs growing. Those are separate questions, you see. So the previous analysis is all about how much income growth is there at the top. Here is how much job growth is there at the top. That could happen without the income of the people at the very top going up. You're just creating more jobs at that top part of the economic structure. Well, again, in the first period for which data, this starts in 1963 because of data availability, you have a pattern that pretty much looks like what you might call job upgrading. Jobs are growing much faster at the top and very strongly in the middle and not at the bottom of the job structure, of the employment structure in the United States. In the period 1992 to 2000, you, for the first time, get this dip in the middle. You still get very strong job growth at the top during a period of job creation, when jobs are growing, but it's polarized. There's really very little job growth going in the middle. This next slide sort of brings this more up to date through 2013, and it also includes what happens to jobs when they're destroyed, not just when they're expanding. And you see that in the early 2000s, for the first time, when jobs are being destroyed, they're being destroyed disproportionately in the middle. It's not just that jobs don't grow in an expansion in the middle of the job structure. When there's a contraction, when jobs are destroyed because of a recession, that's the jobs in the middle that suffer the most. And that occurs again in the Great Recession. You see that the jobs in the middle of the employment structure are the ones that are being the most heavily hit. Those are the jobs that get destroyed. And in the subsequent expansion, it's jobs at the tails which tend to grow the most rapidly. One more just bit of data. This is around trade. Again, roughly we can divide the period over the last 60 years or so into a period before the 1970s and a period after the 1970s. Something happens in the late 70s, early 80s. Something about the American economy really changes. There's this fundamental shift. Before the late 1970s, there was pretty much a kind of balance between imports and exports with, if anything, generally a slight surplus of exports over imports. Something happens around 1980, which is the beginning of the era of deregulation. You know, that's when the Reagan administration is elected, where there's an announcement that government isn't the solution to the problems, it is the problem. Deregulation of industry, deregulation of trade, deregulation of all sorts of sectors begins in the early 80s and accelerates
And it accelerates even during Democratic. This is not a Republican versus Democratic issue. It might have been launched, this new era might have been started in the Reagan administration, but Democrats have pretty much embraced most of this deregulatory zeal. In the most recent period, there's been some pullback among Democrats, but still, what's called the neoliberal era is pretty much something of a consensus on both parties in the United States. Well, something happens with all this deregulation, and suddenly we get tremendous trade deficits. Well, what should be done about this? So that's the balance sheet. That's not a great balance sheet. You know, if you were to say, is that the kind of world you want? With increasing inequality, stagnation at the middle, whenever there's growth, it benefits those at the top way disproportionately. Is that the kind of economy we want? Well, some people say yes, it is. They want that because they want an economy without regulation for its own sake. And then whatever the consequences, well, so be it. I don't think that's the kind of economy that most people, if they could, you know, snap their fingers and choose, they would rather have something more like the patterns that we saw before the 1970s. Than they would like the kinds of patterns we see today. Well, what should be done about this? Well, my colleague Joel Rogers, who is the co-author of this book, who's been very active in, throughout his professional career on precisely these kinds of problems. He directs a research center that's housed in this building called COWS. That was originally, the acronym was Center on Wisconsin Strategy, but it's now really a national research center that focuses on what he calls high road development. That's where that term comes from. And his slogan is, using this road metaphor, close off the low road, pave the high road, and help firms and workers move from the first to the second. Close off the low road capitalism. Low road development is the kind of development we've seen in the last 40 years. Very polarized, good jobs and bad jobs and weak jobs in the middle. Increasing inequality. Close off that road. Let's make it hard for firms and individuals to pursue that kind of economic strategy. Pave the high road. Let's do what is needed to make it easier for both firms and individuals to adopt this, the strategies that reduce inequality and generalize the prosperity that comes with increased productivity, and then do things to help people move from the first to the second. Well, to make this a clearer idea, we have to draw a contrast between high road and low road capitalism. I should say, I use the expressions high road and low road capitalism. Joel Rogers prefers high road and low road development. I don't think it matters really which term we use. So this is a chart that's in the book where I discuss each of the entries pretty carefully.